Hey, this is Cedric Jungelman, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. Today's episode with Tomer Strohleit about political philosophy, the coin of the realm, and the United States of Bitcoin is brought to you by River, the preferred choice for buying Bitcoin. Why do I recommend River? Because River is the best place to build your Bitcoin wealth. And they offer zero fees on recurring Bitcoin purchases. Get up to $100 when you sign up and buy Bitcoin on River at river.com/matrix. Thea is the world's simplest Bitcoin self-custody solution. With their modular multi-sig vaults, you decide how to hold your keys. Whether you want all your keys offline, shared custody with trusted contacts, or robust mobile vaults across multiple iPhones, it's your keys, your Bitcoin. Experience the best-in-class Bitcoin multi-sig vaults. Download Thea now at thea.us/Cedric. That's thea.us/Cedric. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin matrix with Tomer Strohleit for this awesome riff on how Bitcoin is an empire for us all.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Both Bitcoin and the United States have their founding documents. And both these documents clearly state who and what the thing they constitute is meant to serve and do. In the case of the United States, the who is we the people. These unforgettable three words appear not only as the first ones, but they are also written so much larger than any others in the document that clearly they are intended as being of prime importance. It does not say we the rulers or we the elites. Or we the experts, nor does it say we the corporations, or we the politicians, or we the appointed. Nor, moreover, does it say I the president, or I the king, or I the dictator. It treats all people as equals in the founding of America, and goes on to declare its purpose is to provide blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, indicating it is also for all people who will follow. This Constitution then proceeds to state how the mechanisms of America's federal government are to operate, laying out the branches, duties, and processes by which each is to function. This famous preamble, beginning with we the people, does not limit its ambitions only to being for all people, nor merely preserving blessings of liberty. It also lists several other purposes. These are one, to establish justice. Two, to ensure domestic tranquility. Three, to promote the general welfare. And first among all those listed goals, to form a more perfect union. Credit for writing this historic document is attributed to James Madison, but it is clear he was writing it on behalf of the people, and that all the founding fathers of America were in agreement, since they all put their John Hancock on it, including the actual John Hancock himself. It has been over 235 years since this great document was written and enacted. In contrast, unlike the U.S. Constitution, we do not know who wrote Bitcoin's white paper. Some person, or possibly even several people, going by the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto, wrote it. However, just like the U.S. Constitution, this document too invokes who the system is for and how it is meant to operate. Bitcoin too is for all people. The white paper collectively refers to them as peers, and when referring to them individually, as either a party or a participant. Like the U.S. Constitution's invocation of people, the white paper invokes peer right at its beginning and also in its largest lettering. The white paper's stated ambitions may sound far more humble than the U.S. Constitution's. It claims to propose a solution to something known as the double spending problem. However, whereas Madison's document is vague about the definition of its lofty, more perfect union, Satoshi's paper actually provides a mechanism for all peers to form a completely perfect union. That perfect union is a worldwide agreement by all participants on the state of all the money in the world issued under this constitution's rules. The Bitcoin white paper constitutes a money for all people, anywhere and everywhere on Earth, living both now and in posterity. It also constitutes a money wherein all have equality and justice in the use of this money. Recall Madison's established justice from the US Constitution's preamble. It also constitutes a money where all can transact in peace. Recall Madison's domestic tranquility. And it constitutes a money where all are united in complete, continuous, flawless, precisely identical agreement on the state of that money's supply, its balances, and its rules. A completely perfect union. There is no more perfect union than the union of Bitcoin nodes operators' view of the state of Bitcoin. All of us who run the software are in a united state of Bitcoin. To many who study and observe the impact of Bitcoin, this then is a development of historic significance, worthy of being considered potentially as important as the US Constitution. It is a new approach, albeit in a narrower domain, to create a perfect union, establish justice, provide tranquility between and liberty to its participants, both now and in the future, for posterity. These similarities to the US Constitution are noteworthy, to say the least.
They certainly are, Tomer. Thank you for reading that. Tomer Strohleip has been involved in Bitcoin since 2013 and has been writing publicly under his name about it since 2021. He is editor-in-chief at swan.com, a leading Bitcoin on-ramp. Tomer has also written and narrated the short Bitcoin film, Bitcoin is Generational Wealth, available on YouTube. His articles appear on Bitcoin Magazine, swan.com/signal, tomerstrohleip.medium.com, citadel21.com, and more. Tomer Strohleip, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix for the sixth time, sir. How are you?
I'm delighted to be back for a sixth time.
Yeah, man. You were on in September of 2021. We did Rich or Poor Bitcoiners. Rich or Poor Bitcoiners Have What Money Can't Buy. In October of that year, we did Bitcoin is for Everyone. In June of 2022, Beautiful Bitcoin. In April of 2023, Hello, I Am Bitcoin. And in November of last year, 2023, we did the legendary treasure of Satoshi Nakamoto. I mean, you have many, many more pieces to cover beyond that, but that's about 20 or 25 pieces we've covered there, and tremendous proof of work. And they've all been moving shows for me. So I'm super excited to have you back on. It's our first chat in 2024, and it's been over 8 months. So, you know, what is your state of mind?
Well, that's a tough question to ask. I think my state of mind, as we talk about the articles we're going to talk about on today's podcast, is very grounded in political philosophy. Right? Like these, we're talking about four articles today, including this one that we read from first, called "The United State of Bitcoin," in which I compare Bitcoin and its United State amongst node holders to the United States, and how its founding principles are similar and how they're different. And I went through a phase when I wrote these four articles. Three of them were meant to be a trilogy. One of them sits beside it, where I really went back. I studied political science, which is a bit of a misnomer, in my first couple of years of university. I don't think it's much of a science, but I went back to a lot of the roots of political philosophy and everything that I learned in my study of philosophy afterwards as well, and wanted to revisit the founding principles of the greatest nations on Earth and the greatest nation on Earth, the United States of America, and to see what was succeeding and failing for the United States at this day and age, 235 years after its founding, and to see what similarities and differences exist in Bitcoin and how the principles that were discussed back then and at its foundation do or do not apply to Bitcoin, and how historic Bitcoin might be. And I think that was a really, you asked me to read that selection from the United State of Bitcoin. I think it's a really good selection to say, wow, These documents are similar. The purposes of these two creations, one a nation, another a peer-to-peer electronic network, are chasing after the same thing, providing liberty, justice, freedom, and rights for now and into posterity, into those who come after us, if we protect these things. So I think it's really fascinating to look at this. So that's my state of mind as I go into this. My state of mind on the whole thing, you know, the whole world continues to be a crazy place. Sanity is elusive. I think, you know, whenever people are alive, at any point in time that people are alive, they think they're living in modern times, generally living in sane times, in times that are sane, just because. But history looks at them differently. History always looks at people as primitive, as people from the past as primitive, because progress takes place. And it often looks at what became of them. Like, did it lead to a better era? Did it lead to collapse? And if it led to collapse, weren't those people crazy or careless or stupid? Sadly, I think the future, sadly for us to some degree, I don't think history is going to look very favorably at this moment in time. We had so much Western liberal democracies and freedom and productivity and industrialization and scientific method and so much going for us, and we somehow don't seem to be able to make it all work, and it's leading to collapse. So I think Bitcoin plays a really important part in this, and maybe we'll get to some of that as we discuss some of these things, especially the font, you know, the article, "An Empire for Us All," in which we'll talk about when we get to it. So that's my state of mind with everything. How's your state of mind?
Oh man, maybe similar. I mean, I don't want to be a doomer, but I do think we're at, you know, in perilous times, if you will. But my personal state of mind fluctuates almost from maybe quarter to quarter, or, you know, having to having, just in terms of whether my outlook might be positive or negative in my personal life. Because I try to keep a positive outlook and try to see. So I think the world is so really positive around me in so many ways. I mean, the money's broken, but the people are still, and the money fucks everyone up, but the people still seem pretty great. And, you know, for the most part, everyone's trying to keep it together. And, you know, my kids are growing up, and so I kind of have this sort of life is beautiful, like,
wonderful
perspective, like, to just give them, you know, a great world and what they see. And so I try to see it through everything we're living in, and things are pretty good in that sense. But I mean, you look on Twitter and it's like, oh my God, there's a crazy timeline.
Yeah, Twitter is a very doomist place. So
yeah, and so you got to find balance there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to try to focus on family and friends, you know. And it's summer, so I love summer. It's endless summer in Florida, so I don't know. But, you know, I do think this conversation, these pieces that we're discussing, are timely, and more, not so much that, you know, July 4th is next week in the sense of, like, timely this week, but, you know, empires collapsing and what a new empire looks like, and comparing, I think, the white paper to the U.S. Constitution is very interesting lens to kind of look at political philosophy and the philosophy of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So I'd love to kind of get into it, maybe get grounded.
Sure.
So maybe we'll start with the U.S. and, you know, how is the American government, you know, decentralized, you know, at a really high level, you know?
Yeah. Well, one of the big innovations in establishing the United States of America was this notion of the separation of powers. And this was an attempt at some form of decentralization. First of all, keeping the 50 states separate, giving, you know, having two houses, the Congress and the Senate, and most importantly, separating out the legislative, those who write the laws, the executive, those who pass the laws, and the judicial, those who interpret and enforce the laws. And this was meant to prevent corruption. You know, if a king or a dictator could write any law, interpret it themselves, pass it into, you know, not just write it, but pass it into law, that was seen as very dangerous. That was what we were rebelling against. And how to prevent it from arising here was separate the powers. There's going to be legislative bodies, the Congress and the Senate, and and if they manage to agree amongst themselves and bring a bill to the state where it can be passed, then it would go to the executive. That's the role of the president. He or she is the executive, and that's supposed to be their only job. They don't make laws. They can't promise to pass laws that they can't write. They're supposed to just execute. That's what executive means, right? They execute the law into into practice, and then it's up to the Supreme Court, ultimately, the judiciary, to interpret the law and say what is a just interpretation of it. So with these bodies separate, we could count on there being justice. We could count on laws making sense. We could count on the elimination of single points of failure and corruption. And it worked for a time. And I think what we're confronted with now, unfortunately, is a very big blurring of the lines and a high degree of partisanship, and also just a high degree of incentives that bring the powers back together so that they all behave alike. And that they're not really separate, and they're not really grounded in their principles. At the end of the day, the Constitution spells out the fundamental, unchangeable laws of the land, the Bill of Rights, which is meant to be inviolable. And yet we have laws that are written that violate those laws. We have presidents who execute those laws into being, and we have interpretations by courts that allow those rights to continue to be violated. And so the system has somehow, I don't want to say completely broken down, I think that would be an exaggeration, but it's not as sharp, it's not as refined, it's not as effective as it was meant to be. And in particular, as we Bitcoiners often quickly get to the topic, there's something to do with the money here. Elections are won with money. Corporate lawsuits are filed for money. So there's just a tremendous amount role that money plays in these things. And people have become compromised across the board. People will say and do that which gets them more money rather than that which adheres to the principles of the foundation of the United States of America or some other principled foundation. And so when the principles get compromised, and they get compromised through beyond what the separation of powers can provide protection of, we find ourselves in what looks to be a declining and diminishing nation. It's America used to be, and still says, the land of the free and the home of the brave. But when you cross into America and the TSA scans you with a body scanner and feels you up and checks you for under 100 milliliters of liquid and confiscates all this stuff, and it's all this theater, the whole process of which is not actually protecting you, but is also violating your rights to privacy and being free from search, from unreasonable search and seizure. You don't get that impression anymore that you're entering the land of the free. And you're certainly not seeing a lot of bravery. You're seeing a lot of people toeing the line to irrational, theatrical law enforcement. And I don't mean to single out the TSA. It's a good example as someone who's not an American themselves. I used to come to America and it was like, wow, here I'm entering the land of the free and the home of the brave. And that hasn't been the case for quite a while. So we were left with this dilemma, right? We know what leads to abundance in a thriving world, which is freedom. We don't know how to protect it and preserve it any longer. It's become a tug of war battle between blue and red, left and right, corporate interests and non-government organization interests, all of these individuals pulling for what's good for them, not for what's right. Because what's right seems to have been replaced with, what's right used to be, here are the principles that we uphold, and what's right now is what's good for me. And that's a very short-sighted view, and it's not a view that's compatible with living in a civilization. If you're basically saying we divide and conquer, we divide ourselves, we separate ourselves from the others living in our civilization, and we do battle over a fixed size pie, rather than we live in a civilization in which we all cooperate to grow the size of the pie. And, you know, and there are rules by which we get to keep different pieces of the pie and enjoy them, but we're growing a bigger pie. This feels like one of the things that, in particular, large government and monetary debasement really counteract the ability to grow the pie. If entrepreneurs can't be creative, can't be independent, if businesses can't take chances, if everything's regulated and restricted to a great degree, and in the meantime, one party is spending money by printing it out of thin air and spending it in all sorts of directions to win the next election, we don't actually have a pie that's being grown. We have the unit of measure of how big the pie is being shrunk, right? There's $10 trillion of GDP because, not because we're making 10 times as much as we were when there was $1 trillion of GDP, but just we printed the money into oblivion and now nominally there's $10 trillion of GDP, but nobody seems to be getting richer. Nobody seems to be getting happier. You know, the pursuit of happiness is really diminished and more so the younger you are. So that's quite a bit of a rant. But that is that's maybe
no,
an
that's
old
great
question.
Very informative.
How is the United States meant to be decentralized, and what happens when centralization takes place, when a candidate can say for president, say, I'm going to have this law written and passed, and I'm going to load the Supreme Court with judges that will enforce it and interpret it this way. We've now left the realm of separation of powers, of decentralization within the government. We've entered the realm of dictatorship, monarchy, whatever you want to call it. And we're constantly, you know, treading the line on that back and forth. We see some examples of limitations to the power of government, but we see more and more growth in certainly in the size, proportion, and power of government.
Right, sure. The way you kind of framed it in your piece was that separation of powers are not protecting us in the way that they were meant to, and that's been sort of eroding over time. Erosion, I think, is a great word for it. And you outlined a few examples. I love the sort of the omnibus bills. You know, these bills are 1,000 pages long and nearly impossible to read by the time, you know, they got to be voted on.
They're written by who knows who.
Right.
All these, not even the elected officials. The elected officials have no opportunity to read any of them. They ask their assistants, is the thing that I want for me in here? Right. So, and who cares about what the other costs, what everybody else is getting? Like, is what I want for me in here? And if it is, I'm voting in favor of it. And it could be filled with all sorts of other garbage. And then it needs to get passed, always in an emergency, always in a hurry. The use of emergency powers is the most abused form of power that our governments take advantage of. They say, we need to do this. The government will cease functioning tomorrow if we don't pass this 1,000-page bill that was written only yesterday and that no person in the world has read. And it needs to be.
Yeah, I was listening to Marty Bent on Coffee with Mike, and he reminded me, you know, just how much pork and horse trading there was in TARP, you know, one of the most important critical bills, economic bills in the history of the United States. And it was just jammed full with pork and BS. You go on to mention executive orders, you know, and it was an executive order alone which confiscated gold in 1933 and closed the gold window in 1971. So, you know, you don't need three branches there. You know, you got the revolving door.
If I could just interrupt you, right? Like, our money became unsound, not through bypassing the separation of powers, through the issuance of executive orders that came like a thief in the night, twice, you know, separated by a few decades. But, you know, the value of gold was diminished, and the redeemability of the dollar for gold was eliminated by a simple executive order, right? Like, that is a dictatorial style of order that should be reserved, that shouldn't be able to change all the money in the world for everybody. And yet there it was. And it's quite an abuse of power.
Right. Yep. The revolving door with regulators and public companies, or even just whatever, corporate entities. And we have campaign contributions, you know, billions of dollars spent on lobbying politicians to craft and pass legislation. You know, so all of this is just, you know, eroding the separation of powers. So how is Bitcoin a different approach to separating powers?
Super. So Bitcoin actually addresses these same three branches, the legislative, the making of the rules, right? The laws are the rules of our civilization. The executive, the execution, the bringing into action the rules, and the judicial, the determination, the enforcement of the rules. So how does this work in Bitcoin? I didn't realize there were lawmakers, presidents, and judges in Bitcoin, but there are, right? The lawmaker was Satoshi Nakamoto. He wrote the code, he wrote the rules, he wrote the law, and he wrote it in a form that can be executed, right? And when you execute the program of Bitcoin, when you run the program of Bitcoin, you are executing the code. You are the executor. You are the executive. You are executing the code. Like, we use the same words even, right? Despite the fact that executive is an old word, it has taken on the right meaning. So the code is the law. Your node that runs the code is the executive. And the judiciary is also embedded in your node. Every time somebody sends a transaction that comes to your node judges it, says it does it have the right criteria? Is it spending an unspent transaction? If it was spending an already spent transaction or a non-existent transaction, it will judge that as an invalid transaction and kick it out. Does it have the right signature? Does it have the right conditions to be added to the blockchain? If so, it will continue, it will accept it and forward it on to other judges, all the other nodes, to judge it valid or not. When a block comes across that a miner has solved, your node will judge it. It will say, is the proof, does the proof of work check out? Does every single transaction in there correspond to the rules, to the law? And if it does, it will accept it. It will judge it as valid and allow it to pass into history. And if it doesn't meet the criteria, it will reject it. It will judge it as invalid. And the big difference between human laws and Bitcoin laws, you know, previous laws, and is like someone can pass a law that says you cannot murder somebody, but it doesn't say you cannot murder somebody. It knows you can murder somebody. It says if you murder somebody, there's a punishment for it. Bitcoin says you cannot double spend. And it's not if you double spend, this is the penalty. It's like you cannot double spend. These are unbreakable laws because they are before they get to be executed, before the action is executed, it is judged. So there's a reordering of things. The laws are written, actions are taken, they are judged as legal or not, legitimate or not. And if they are legitimate, they are executed. And if they are illegitimate, they are rejected. So it's a different way of following the law. It's a different way. And it's possible only because the conduct within Bitcoin is so precise, right? It's mathematical, it's physical, and it can be prevented before it takes place, right? We cannot prevent a murder before it takes place. We just don't, we can't do it. We can't prevent a theft before it takes place of physical goods. But in the Bitcoin realm, in the Bitcoin constitution, we can decide what will be allowed in and what will not be allowed in. And we have our rules, and we say that which violates the rules is not allowed to happen. It will not happen. And so we've gone from thou shalt not double spend, thou should not double spend, to thou cannot double spend. And so it's a new legal framework. It's a new political framework. We haven't discussed this. Like, what is political philosophy? What is politics? And politics is a branch of philosophy that deals with how people should interact with one another. And it's built on top of ethics. Like, if you don't have a code of ethics, you can't really build any political system. And if you take a look at any political system, it's built on top of some code of ethics. It's trying to enforce some moral code. And the moral code of Bitcoin at its simplest is you shouldn't steal. So we're going to build a system in which you can't steal. You shouldn't commit financial fraud. I'm going to build a system in which you cannot commit financial fraud. And that is the really powerful innovation in Bitcoin. And it, I think one of the things that's most important, you know, as we review how this is different, it's like nobody is a professional node runner, no, as opposed to someone as a professional legislator or a president or a judge. We all have the ability to do all the roles, and we're all invited to participate in all the roles, but none of us are getting paid to do any of the roles, and none of us need to get paid to do any of the roles. And I think this is, you know, you can't bribe me into accepting an invalid transaction for a few reasons. One, the incentive isn't there, but two, even if you did successfully bribe me into accepting an invalid transaction, nobody else would accept it. And the cost, so the cost to create an invalid transaction that everyone will approve is greater than the value of any kind of invalid transaction, because everyone knows if they start fucking around with what they accept as transactions, then the whole value of the system will collapse. And so what's the value in receiving a Bitcoin if a Bitcoin is worthless? This perfection of the alignment of the incentives in Bitcoin, along with the ability to enforce its laws in a way that isn't punishing people who broke the laws, but preventing anyone from breaking the laws in the first place, creates an entirely new way of looking at a political system. It still has those separations of powers. It's a new look at the separation of powers. They all exist, but any one of us can participate in all of them. And the distribution and decentralization of those powers, that any one of us can take on any of the roles. In particular, you know, only one person can be the president of the United States. Only one person can be the executive. Every single person in the United States of America and every other person in the world can be the executive of Bitcoin simultaneously. Right, we're all able to execute the code, and to execute the code, not just to say this should be a law and everyone should behave accordingly to it. It's like we're enforcing the law in its execution. So we are the judge, jury, executioner, if you will. It's interesting that executive and executioner have the same root, but we're all in that position to prevent the execution of a violation of the rules. And that's a very powerful separation of powers. Nobody can violate Bitcoin's rules for that reason. So it's a new look at it. Maybe was or was not what the way Satoshi was thinking about it. But if you're holding up the two systems to one another, you can see that they have these three branches. They're structured very differently. And in Bitcoin, nobody can break the law of Bitcoin, whereas in the law, people can break the law, and then we have a whole, you know, machination, contraption system to figure out how to attempt to remedy that through punishing the lawbreaker, perhaps taking some of their property away and giving it back to their victim, the person who was hurt, who was damaged by the law that they broke. But in Bitcoin, nobody can break any of the laws. And that's really interesting. So it exists in a narrower domain. Like, we have Bitcoin and murder can still exist, and so we still need laws and courts to defend the right to life. But when it comes to the money, we've got a system where nobody can break the rules. And the rules are very, very straightforward and very simple.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of maybe think about that just, you know, legislative power is available to anyone. So anyone can propose new laws.
Anyone can write new code. Getting everyone else to execute that code, that takes a little bit more work. And you need everyone. You don't need to convince the president of the United States to execute that code. You need to convince everybody in the world to execute that code. And that's the separation of power there. Like, you're free to write a law. You don't have to be elected to Congress to write a law. But you're not free to force anybody else to run that law. We're in a stasis condition until everybody agrees to change the law, and everybody's going to enforce the law as it is already in existence.
Right. And, you know, other things I'm thinking about there are consensus. Mm-hmm. And so you have laws, and you mentioned, you know, the executive power is available to anyone. So yet it requires everyone. And you go on to write, if code is law, then it is running code that enacts that law, giving it executive approval. You're literally having your computer execute code. Take a few seconds to think about that. You are executing code the entire time you run Bitcoin. You are passing the laws of Bitcoin through your node the whole time, just as others are executing the exact same laws or code as well. And so anyone can execute code with a computer. Anyone can suggest new code. It's really hard to get new code in there. It's not easy to pass laws. But, you know, how many times have we passed maybe major laws?
We've had a handful of, I don't know what the exact number is.
Okay, maybe consensus changes since 2017.
Yeah, since 2017, well, 2017, we had SegWit and we had Taproot, and that's it. We've had two times, and both times it came with a lot of discussion, a lot of preparation, a lot of persuasion. In 2017, it led to a separation of the nation, split into Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin. And Bitcoin Cash took their ball and said, "We're not playing anymore in your consensus system. We're not playing according to the rules of Bitcoin as you now want them. We're playing according to new rules as we now want them." And off they went. And it is interesting because, in a sense, it's like there was a rebellion, there was a revolution. But the revolution doesn't have to have only one survivor and one winner. It's not the same thing. Cyberspace can be split into, multiple parts. And that's what happened. The market decided that Bitcoin Cash was only worth a few hundred bucks while Bitcoin was worth $60,000. But so there was something to be said for that. And the number of people who remained in Bitcoin Cash became a very small number. But you were allowed to live in both territory simultaneously, right? If you had one Bitcoin beforehand, you had one Bitcoin afterwards and one Bitcoin Cash, and you weren't forced to choose one or the other. You could choose both. You could stay in both and see how it played out. You would have to execute both versions of the software. You would have to maintain both versions of the software if you wanted to do that, notably. And again, for reasons that are kind of outside the scope of this conversation, people overwhelmingly chose Bitcoin, both economically and in terms of using it for transactions, storing wealth in it, and running the software. But this is the power that you have, right? You're not someone with one vote out of 100 million voters, where your vote, you're not sure it's going to count for everything, or you win some, you lose some. You get to decide what the rules of the system are. There's a tremendous incentive to stay aligned with the rules of the system. And that 2017 episode really demonstrated the tremendous cost of trying to leave the system and create your own system. You have to start from scratch and you don't have the network effect. But it's not a violent, once again, it's not like the physical world in which violence decides things at the end of the day. It is a peaceful world where people can go their own way and they pay the price economically for making bad decisions, and they get rewarded economically for making good ones. So people are incentivized to make good decisions
And
mostly.
that's great. That's good. Good is good. I want to read a little bit from the piece. This trade-off of being allowed to execute whatever you want for yourself, but being able to impose it on nobody else, is a very different one than abiding by the rules of intermittent democratic elections. The incentive to agree to the same rules in Bitcoin is massive, and the ability to change the rules requires consensus, not a simple majority. Also consider that every minute of every day starts with the rules that everyone agreed to the minute before. And to change the rules, you need everyone's computers to make the same rule changes at the exact same time. So again, it's very hard to change the rules. Not impossible, but it is very, very hard. If we pause to think about it, perhaps one of the biggest problems with our current system of government is that it is in fact too easy to change the rules. Perhaps that's what politicians do way too much of. It isn't hard to make this case. Whereas very few proposals to amend Bitcoin come forward at the time of writing, Congress put forth a 4,100-page long omnibus bill with hundreds of new rules costing $1.7 trillion. And the president, the executive, said he would sign this bill into law the moment it hit his desk. Now, that sounds like a much easier process to get executive approval than in Bitcoin, perhaps one that's far too easy and doesn't achieve what the separation of powers was meant to. And he said judicial power, executive laws are inviolable. What does that mean?
Sorry, read that part again.
Judicial power, executive laws are inviolable.
I'm not sure.
Laws most government laws most must be both enforced and interpreted. So we
Oh, so that's the point that I was making before. In
oh,
Bitcoin,
okay.
the laws are inviolable. You cannot break the law. You cannot do it. You cannot get a invalid block into the blockchain. And you cannot break the laws of what it takes to add a block to the blockchain. You cannot put an invalid transaction into the blockchain. You can't even put it into a single node's mempool, right? Like, that's how inviolable the laws are. You try to break the law, and everything in the physical realm of that system says, no, this will not happen, and you cannot do it. So that's the power of the of the judgment that happens as you execute the code, right? When you execute the code, a transaction comes in, the code looks at it through its execution and it says, this is an invalid transaction, I'm dropping it. And if the one node gives you a few too many of those things, say, I'm dropping my connection with this node. I don't want to hear from him anymore. Right? So that node gets shadow banned or dropped from your peer-to-peer network. It's a really, really powerful system. No violence took place. No wrongdoing got to take place. It was simply prevented in the first place. And that's possible only in Bitcoin. It's not possible in the real physical world. We have a moral system that says you shouldn't kill somebody, but you can still kill somebody. And that is not going to change anytime soon. But now we have an economic system that says you should not double spend, and you will not double spend, and you cannot double spend, and nobody will double spend.
Yeah, and I can't help to think about sort of case law, soft forks, potential for hard forks, yeah. And SegWit and Bcash, and maybe where things are going. I know change is slow, but maybe there's more changes to come. I think of what we're going through maybe with Ocean and transactions, and just sort of like what might be needed there. But I kind of want to move through that. Maybe we'll come back to that later if it applies. But you wrote in another article, The Legendary Treasure of Satoshi Nakamoto, which was the last show we did together. I recommend people go back and check that out if they haven't already done so. You wrote, Bitcoin asks us to separate the idea of money from the institutions and people that have come to control money. In today's world, these happen to be governments, central banks, financial insiders, powerful multinational corporations, militaries, and other hugely powerful institutions. Bitcoin is money separated from all human control. Anything about sort of human control, and sometimes humans are put into power. And I think you included, you included a quote in the beginning of a new separation of powers from Lord Acton, which was mentioned, I guess, in 1887. Power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah.
So I want to discuss another piece of yours, a new peaceful transition of power.
Yeah.
And let's talk a little bit about, I guess, historical politics. You know, right now, I think in America, I think the transition of power is peaceful. There's no sort of someone in control or ruler or president or king or whatever. Right. That's refusing to leave and the military getting involved.
Yeah.
Has it always been like that?
No, I mean, this idea of a peaceful transition of power, which we take for granted, is something that we really take for granted, that we don't appreciate how often people got into power. And the way you got them out of power was you killed them. And that was the only way you got people out of power. Right. And those people knew that. So if they thought you were trying to get into power, they would try to kill you. Murder was pretty much the way that power changed, or sometimes people died of natural causes, and so you'd have a peaceful transition of power to their heir if nobody contested it. We recently saw King Charles appointed as was coronated as King of Great Britain after a long reign of Queen Elizabeth II. When she passed away, nobody contested it, and so King Charles, Prince Charles, became King Charles. That is how power transitions in a monarchy, but very, very much was the case. And again, people don't know pretty recent history. There were a lot of wars in Europe, wars between royal families and marriages between royal families to seek power. So power was consolidated through the marriage of powerful families and taken through force of war. And this was very common. If you look at the history of Europe before World War One, there's constantly wars popping up between nations, and nations that previously didn't exist did exist. And, there's just a whole long legacy of monarchs going to war with one another. This notion of having a democratic election and the winner of the democratic election peacefully taking power according to some kind of right is a reasonably recent phenomenon in the long history of humankind, and one that hopefully we can continue to see as something new arises to replace our democracy, or if we can preserve our democracy and have it continue to be effective, that would be great too. But I think a lot of people are doubtful of our democracy's ability to continue for reasons we discussed earlier, that there's just too much corruption of the separation of powers, and it's looking more and more like what the world looked like before democracy took over. I mean, the fact that we've had how dynasties of families in American politics is quite different. You know, that we've had two Bushes, a father and a son, be president of the United States, and a brother be the governor of a state, and then we had Bill Clinton as president and his wife running later. This indicates that there's something more than just the most qualified individual in the nation. It's pretty. They must have some amazing genes in the Bush family that father and son would both be president. And here in Canada, where I live, Justin Trudeau, who's not a very good prime minister, possibly the worst we've ever had, the son of the man who was prime minister when I first became conscious of politics. There's something going on here that feels much more like inherited leadership than meritocracy-based leadership.
Yeah, that's for sure. We don't have to beat the political aspect of that with a dead horse, but I mean, you see it in acting and music as well. I mean, just tremendous.
Listen,
Doesn't seem
nepotism.
the best is rising to the top necessarily, but people put there.
Nepotism helps. There's power. There's power structures that are established, and people help out their next of kin, and you know, and their family and their friends. We hope that politics is somehow immune from that to protect and preserve us. Because if it isn't, then political power can be abused and used to violate our rights. And again, I say political systems are built off of ethics. There's a lot of presumed ethics when I say that, right? I presume that individuals should have inviolable rights. Well, hold on. I mean, it took us thousands of years of politics and dictatorship and kingships and all these things to get to the point where anybody would agree that some pleb has the same rights as the king, you know, with his divine power. So there's an ethical basis of what's trying to be protected when you say no, you know, power should be decentralized, distributed. It shouldn't be able to be abused, and by abuse, I mean to violate the rights of others. And these are all really powerful and important ethical principles to discuss, which we might discuss, you know, we might have a whole other appearance on to talk about ethics and why rights are moral and why the violation of rights is immoral. But that's another big topic, which these four articles don't actually cover. But let's turn it to
Yeah.
Bitcoin represents a new approach to the peaceful
Yep.
trend.
So I'll read a little bit from your piece to
Yeah, sure.
transition through. So, however, this process is far from perfect. Today, we see signs of controversy around the process, with many people questioning the legitimacy and fairness of elections, and others questioning whether those questioners represent a threat to democracy. Even politicians who depend greatly on the peaceful transition of powers have themselves cast doubts on both the integrity of some elections or declared that some block of voters are a danger to democracy. All of these developments are concerning and remind us we should not be taking for granted the peaceful transition of power. Without a non-violent means of transitioning power, we would be left with only two alternatives: either no transition of power or transition only by violent means. Neither is desirable or even tolerable, really. So yeah, without getting into how we could discuss, fixing democracy or whether it should be fixed or can it be fixed, what power exists in Bitcoin and how is it transitioned?
Okay, so I think mining is the analog here. And in Bitcoin, power has the potential to be transitioned roughly once every 10 minutes. The power in Bitcoin is the power to write the blockchain, to write the next block in the blockchain. And there are different parties who attempt to wield that power. Again, as we discussed earlier, nobody has the power to add data to the blockchain that's in violation of the rules. So that's a really positive thing in the first place. Nobody seeks power to try to change the rules. No miner can change the rules of Bitcoin. This is, of course, something that's very confused by newcomers to Bitcoin. People who don't understand how Bitcoin works thinks, well, miners, you know, if they get 51%, they can change the rules of Bitcoin. No, they can't. Your node will continue to run the same code it ran They'll continue to execute it. They'll continue to judge every block that they put forward, and anything in any block that violates any of the rules will cause the entire block to be rejected. So miners can rewrite the history of the blockchain by proposing valid blocks in a longer chain than what existed before, rewriting some of the blocks, but they cannot change the rules of Bitcoin. But they are the ones with the power, and they're the ones who use power to have the power to write the next block, and they're rewarded for it, right? So there's a tremendous incentive to seek this power. And from one block to the next, you'll find different miners mined different blocks. People tend to look at it through which pools mine the blocks. That's a little bit of, a bit beside the point. But even if you look at it, you know, you'll have Ant Pool mine one, and then you'll have Ocean mine one, and then you'll have Foundry mine one, and then you'll have Mara mine one. And each of these things, it's like, okay, you know, Mara wrote the last block, but the power is shifted now, and Foundry has written this block, and the power is shifted again, and Ocean has written the next block, and it's a peaceful transition of power, right? It's like there's no war involved in this. Immediately, as soon as Foundry says, we found the newest block, everyone checks it, everyone executes it, everyone judges it. If it's judged as valid, everyone says, yes, you have the power to add the next block. We all accept that you've added the next block, and now we'll all move on to the next tournament, the next election, if you will, the next contest. And so we have this peaceful transition of power all over the world. And the reality is it's not Ocean that found a block. It's some miner who's pointing at that pool. So there's even more decentralization, distribution, a change of power. Like the agreement within a pool is that all the miners who are trying to add the next block agree to a common template and a common reward so that they can share in the rewards. Because they're not all going to discover it at the same time. Again, this isn't a discussion about how mining pools work, but there's even more decentralization than just the mining pools, and their names seems to indicate. And as the power shifts, Bitcoin handles it completely peacefully, and nobody contests it, and there's no reason for anybody to contest any outcome, because everyone can validate it entirely, right? It's not, nobody can say, oh, they counted the votes illegally, they did something different with the hash. It's like, it's purely objective, it's purely mathematically analyzable. And if something starts to go wrong, like we worry that someone has too much hash power, there are steps that people can take, including leaving the pool that has too much hash power. And again, we're not going to get into what remedies would exist if we found ourselves in a transition of power that didn't seem fair any longer. We have this system to transition power from block to block every 10 minutes. There is no leader in that sense, right? It's not like we put somebody in charge of Bitcoin. And again, it's a reverse. Like when you elect a politician, you usually give them 4 years to try to fulfill their promises. Mm. But in that 4 years, they have a lot of power. They have this legislative power, especially in situations where there isn't that much of a separation of powers. They're going to try to pass as many laws as they can to allegedly follow through on their promises. These promises may or may not violate our rights. They'll certainly change the rules that existed beforehand. That's what they're running to do. They're running to, their whole platform is how they're going to change the rules so that the world is better for you. Bless you. So they're going to change the rules. And the people who are doing mining are transitioning power in a very different way.
Thank you.
It's like, when they get the block, their power is over. They immediately get rewarded for doing the job. And what's the job that they're doing? They're enforcing the rules, doing the proof of work so that Bitcoin's blocks get added only once every 10 minutes with only valid transactions. So they're obeying the rules themselves. They're not changing the rules. And in obeying the rules and doing the work that's required, they get paid for it after the fact. A politician gets paid for it before, like, you know, they can get fired 4 years later for doing a shit job. They usually get reelected, even though people think they did a shit job, which speaks to something about our electoral system. The approval ratings are at their all-time low. They're well below 50%, but incumbents get reelected 89% of the time or some ridiculous thing. In Bitcoin, they're not getting a block. They're not getting paid a reward and then saying, I promise to do this if you give me the power. They're like, I did this work. Give me the power. Here's the proof that I did the work. Now give me the power to add the block to the blockchain. So again, a shifting of the order of events as they happen so that you don't end up with broken promises for miners. You don't end up with disputes that can't be resolved over the shift, the transition of power from one miner mining at the tip to the next miner mining at the tip. And that, and this provides this continuous, you know, change of power roughly every 10 minutes that goes on and on forever peacefully. In the article, I go into detail about what happens when two miners find a block at the same time. It's kind of interesting, but it's not necessarily worth going into in this podcast.
Yeah, I love how you frame it up as, you know, first, all the contestants, i.e. the miners, accept the latest state of the ledger.
Yeah.
And this is really, really important. Finally, when a miner does all the work and finds a valid result, they share it immediately with the network. And everyone in the network can easily verify for themselves whether or not the solution is valid. This is the proof that the miner did the work and got lucky enough to beat out everyone else competing in the contest. But I just love the transparency there and the immediacy of the results and everyone being in agreement again on the state. And so, you know, you frame it up this way as well, considering some, you know, aspects of the contest. Nobody is in charge. There is no ceremony on transitioning power. There is no advantage to the incumbent who got to add the most recent block. There is no promise to be kept or broken by the winner. The work is done. For one brief instant, the winner had the power to add the next block to the ledger. Then they were once again on the exact same footing as everyone else, having to do exactly the same work as anyone else for their chance to win the next round of the competition. And it was all perfectly peaceful. And this works in practice. It's peaceful. Everyone's in complete agreement of all the system participants, with complete agreement of all the system participants at the intervals built into it from its inception and issuing the rewards that were described at its inception.
What a better system than our existing political system, where everybody says the election wasn't fair, he's trying to cheat, he's trying to register these voters that shouldn't be allowed to vote. It's like, then you need a whole ceremony and a whole transition and this and that and the other, and you know, and the question of fairness gets raised in every single context, whereas here everyone's, there's no dispute, these guys found the last block. There's no question about it. We all of our nodes could validate this, the exact same thing. Did they or did they not actually find the next block? And if they did, they get the reward. And if they didn't, they don't.
Right. And there's no hanging chads and court cases and
people
getting involved.
Yeah. They if they propose a block, like, everyone's going to be in agreement as to whether it's valid or not. And that's really, really unique. Because when someone proposes a rule or someone proposes something else in the law, there's going to be controversy. There's not going to be agreement. So we, like, you know, Satoshi, he put the thread through the eye of the needle in such a brilliant way with the invention of the system, where it works and it doesn't break and it continues to work, and it's like, and it gets stronger and stronger, or at least stays equally strong. It doesn't get weaker over time, right? Bitcoin continues to deliver blocks at regular intervals, continues to do exactly what it was meant to do consistently. And we're not witnessing, as the term that you liked before, we're not witnessing the erosion of the decentralization. We're not witnessing the erosion of the compliance to the spending rules, right? There's not a single rule has been broken in the whole time that Bitcoin has existed. And we shouldn't ever expect one to be broken. That's really extraordinary.
Yeah, and I want to read a little piece from this. So the only way to play successfully in this contest is to play by the strategy outlined earlier. These aren't rules enforced by a referee, a court, or a police force. They're just the only logical way to play the game. Nobody is in charge of Bitcoin, so nobody forces anyone to play by the rules. It's just that the forces of nature punish anyone who plays differently. Is this going to, you know, help or transition power away from central banks to Bitcoin? Is that part of this transition?
You know, you want to talk about ambiguous rules that nobody even knows, like, that don't even really exist, right? Like, a central bank gets to make up the rules as they go along. The interest rates are going to go up 0.25% today. We're going to not do anything today. We're going to start buying securities and putting them on our balance sheet with printed money. We're going to lend money to some, like, it just, they make shit up as they go along all the time, but they wear nice suits and they speak and economic ease so that you can't really understand what they're talking about. There are no rules. Whenever someone can change the rules, the reality is there are no rules, right? Like they exist at the what's the term, at the pleasure of the rulemaker, right? And if the rulemaker doesn't find them to his pleasure, he'll change the rules. And that's what we've seen with central bank fiat currencies all over the world all the time. And it's clear that the rules are changed to the advantage of the central bankers and their friends and family. So this is a little bit beside the point of the transition of the peaceful transition of power, but I think it's why people will ultimately choose Bitcoin, because they value something that is predictable to them and that is fair, and that they have equal power to everybody else. We're all peers in Bitcoin. There's nobody who is the chairman of the Federal Reserve of Bitcoin, who gets to change the price of money, the issuance of money. Like, nobody gets to change it. Bitcoin's monetary policy has never been changed. And I'd go so far as to say, and it never will be, right? And with a lot of confidence. Whereas I can say the monetary policy of the United States changes every time there's an FOMC meeting.
Yeah. And you wrote, governments have not always had the powers that they now have through central banking. Yeah. You know, and there's good reason to be optimistic, not only about the transition of monetary policy power away from unpredictable central entities to reliable, predictable, and fair Bitcoin, but also this happening peacefully. Just as the internet digitized and disrupted many industries, transforming them in both predictable and unpredictable ways, regardless of whether those industries embrace the internet or fought against it, Bitcoin appears to be poised to do the same to the structure of the money industry.
Yeah.
I'd like to turn. Oh, sorry.
No, I was like, Bitcoin is the internet of money in more ways than we appreciate. What the internet did to traditional media and telecommunications, which is to take a lot of the power away from big old central pieces and give voice to individuals, Bitcoin is set to do to money, to the finance industry. And it's not only the central banks who have the power of the army behind them or the licensed banks that they give permission to do business. It's like, you are your own bank. You store your own wealth. You transmit it to other entities who store their own wealth. It's a level of freedom that hasn't existed in finance in a long time, especially with this volume of capital. And so it's going to change things, and it's going to change them for the better. So people shouldn't be afraid of it. Even the people who are affected by it shouldn't be too afraid of it. Like, they've done well enough. They should be smart enough and use their fiat to buy Bitcoin. But they shouldn't think that they can continue to protect fiat in a world where people now have a choice and they can't stop them from, and the central bankers can't stop people from choosing it. So just a matter of education now and information spreading, just like it was with the internet. You know, and the internet was a little bit slow. It was clunky. There weren't great apps written for it. The features and functionality of HTML weren't what they are right now. It wasn't portable. Wi-Fi didn't exist. Like, it had all these limitations. But as the limitations got knocked down one after the other, it eventually overwhelmed everything else. And there's no analog telephone anymore. It's gone. There's no analog TV anymore. It's gone. It's all distributed over the internet. There's hardly any newspapers left. They're gone. And you and I are here, broadcasting video, you know, from two different locations in the world, recording it and able to rebroadcast it so that whoever wants to watch it can watch it. That's the shift of power that the internet gave to content creators. It used to be only if you had a television license and very expensive camera that you would be able to get a broadcast out there. And you know, there were only a few people with broadcast licenses because they were broadcasting over analog radio waves. It's all done. It's finished. There's, you know, you and I are here today because of that. And a generation from now, people will be doing with money what they're doing with media right now, which is freely produced, you know, freely exchanging it, freely using it with one another without constraint, without requiring permission and acceptance from the licensed few.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing, you know, there's nothing new under the sun and not many paradigm shifts, but I think Bitcoin is one.
Sure. It's huge.
And I want to talk about your next piece, The United State of Bitcoin. Right. It's a great title. Still comparing Bitcoin to politics. So the state of the state, the noun state has two meanings. The particular condition that someone or something is in at a specific time, or a nation or territory considered as an organized political community under one government. The first definition applies broadly to practically anything, like what's your current state of the mind, like I asked you at the beginning of the show, and it changes all the time after all, and what state of matter is some body of water in the atmosphere taking? Is it a gaseous cloud, a liquid rain, or solid crystal snowflakes? What's the state of a particular patient in a hospital? Are they in stable, serious, or critical condition? So state's kind of an interesting word.
Yeah.
And kind of thinking about sort of Bitcoin as a state is kind of interesting. And you go on to say, let's begin with a big question. Why these exist? For whom and to what purpose? So a couple of quotes here. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. You mentioned that in the piece that you read, how that was just so prominent. We, the people.
Everyone recognized it, right? If I say we, the people, you should be able to picture those huge letters at the top of the United States Declaration.
Yeah, for sure.
We, the people. It's so much bigger than everything else.
Yep.
Follows with, in order to form a more perfect union.
So we talked a little bit. I mean, you kind of read out a little bit about, you know, we the people and sort of, the other quote, Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system, which is the title of Bitcoin.pdf, also known as the Bitcoin white paper. So we talked a little bit about it, but I want to kind of expand on that a little bit. But so maybe we can start with how is Bitcoin a new or different approach to maybe the same goals as the U.S. Constitution?
Yeah. Well, okay. So this was in the piece that I was reading up front. There's various things that the United States Declaration of Independence set out to do. It's set to establish the fruits of freedom for those living now and into posterity. And Bitcoin clearly aims to do those same things, right? It aims to give all the participants in the Bitcoin state, the people who are maintaining the state of Bitcoin, right? The same these rights to transmit and receive from one another without censorship, without interference, without interruption. It limits the power of any other state, any other actor, to have any power to restrict their conduct. And it aims to do this over a long period of time. Right? You know, the United States Constitution says for ourselves and for our posterity, which means for our descendants. And it's the same thing with Bitcoin, right? We talk about having low time preference. It talks about doing it peacefully, right? The U.S. Constitution does. And so does Bitcoin, right? Like, again, we've discussed that extensively in our discussions of the other two articles. Everything happens, a peaceful transition of power, a peaceful enforcement of the law of Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is really achieving a lot of the same goals. And I should maybe go back to the segment that I read before, but it's achieving a lot of the same goals as the United States Constitution set out to achieve in a narrower context, but with much more clarity and precision. And it's not very clear what it means when we say we want to form a perfect union at the United States, but it's very clear what we say when we want to form a perfect union within Bitcoin. We are perfectly united at this on the state of Bitcoin. Your node, which I presume you have one of, and my nodes, which I have more than one of, are identically in completely precise agreement. And they're united on every bit of every transaction that's ever taken place in the entire history of Bitcoin up until the last block was discovered. The perfect union. And so is every other Bitcoin node in the world. A completely perfect, they're perfectly united in the state of the blockchain. Well, that's a united state, if you will, right? There's a perfectly united state of things. And it's not just a fun play on words that the United States of America sought to be a more perfect union. Bitcoin is the idealization within the context of money of what the fathers of the United States, the founding fathers, actually believed in and sought to pursue. How can we find perfection in the union of the state, of the nation, right? And within this context of money, Bitcoin is forming a perfectly united group of nodes all over the world in which there's no disagreement. It is a perfect union. And you know, it's the most perfect union that has ever existed. And it exists all over the world, not just even within one The geography of Bitcoin is the whole fucking world, right? It's like anywhere that someone spins up a node, and now with satellites orbiting the Earth, covering the whole Earth with internet simultaneously, it literally is every square inch of the planet can be in perfect union with every other square inch of the planet. So really, really extraordinary achievement.
Well, perfect system for a perfect union.
Yeah.
And, kind of continuing on the United State of Bitcoin, you wrote this other piece, Bitcoin and Empire for Us All.
Yeah.
I think it kind of would be good to kind of wrap up with this. So I think, because I think it goes with the other ones. You think about, peaceful transition of power, what power is.
Yeah. Yeah, this is actually the one that I wrote first amongst all of these four. And for me, it was, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the decline of the American Empire, the decline of the West. And Ray Dalio had a whole book and a very popular video that accompanied the book, which summarized it, that spoke a lot about the rise and fall of empires throughout history. He studied the rise and fall of empires throughout history, and he sees that what happens is there's some new empire ri starts to rise. Its citizens are very hardworking and very intelligent and very ambitious and very disciplined, and they build something great. And things get too good. This sounds a lot like the fourth turning. Things get good, and the leadership of the empire becomes what's the word he uses? He not complacent, not corrupt, but I'm forgetting the exact word that he uses, but they become decadent. I think maybe that's the word he's looking for. And they start abusing their power, and they become irresponsible, and the empire begins to decline. And quite often, in addition to becoming bad leaders who pass bad laws and violate the principles of the nation, they also debase the money. They spend into debt, and they somehow debase the money. And this keeps happening over and over, and it, boy, oh boy, does it feel like it's happening here. And I think that was Ray Dalio came this close to saying, and it's happening here, right? He said, just, he pointed out in so many different ways how we are debasing the money in the West and how our leadership is quite decadent with their private jets and their WEF ceremonies and their, flying off in their private jets to tell us that we shouldn't drive cars. So we're seeing the repeat of this. And it occurred to me that Bitcoin is a different kind of empire, but it's still worthy of being called an empire. Like, what is an empire? It is this set of rules, this governance structure that takes place over a large geography, a geography even larger than its an individual nation. And you can tell which empire you're in usually through two things. One is, what flags and armies do you see over there? The uniforms and the flags and all the symbols of the empire. But it's also what is being used for money. What's the coin that's being used? And if they're using the Roman denarius, you're in Rome. And if they're using the American dollar, you're in the American Empire. And there are many parts of the world at points in time in history that are peacefully disputed because people are using multiple currencies from different empires in this in the same place. And but wherever you see a coin being used, you're in the coin of that particular empire. And this is what's interesting about the Bitcoin empire, right? Bitcoin is this coin. It's maybe got a flag, I don't know, or a big orange symbol. It certainly doesn't have an army, but it does have all these node runners and miners distributed all over the world, minting this coin, protecting this coin, saving in this coin, using this coin. And so it's an empire that's spreading one person at a time throughout the world and is growing quickly, right? The value of its coin is growing, the purchasing power of its coin is growing, the protection that it has from attack from other empires is growing through decentralization and proof of work. And so here is a different type of empire, an empire without an emperor, without a leader. And I point out, well, this is kind of interesting because the very things that caused all the other empires to collapse, decadence and corruption of its leadership and debasement of its currency by that leadership, Bitcoin is immune to. Bitcoin is immune to the decadence of its leadership because it has none. When you have no leader, he can't become decadent. So it just like it solves the problem of corrupt leaders by taking the human beings right out of the equation. There's no leaders, and so they can't be decadent. And it solves the debasement problem in part by also removing the leaders who would debase it, but by being undebasable. Right? Bitcoin has its issuance algorithm that everyone who participates in the empire is incentivized to continue to enforce forever through this decentralized power, the separation of power, the peaceful transition of power from one block to the next. So we have this empire that anyone can join that should last forever, that isn't going to suffer the fate of every empire that came before it. I think this is the most historic aspect of all of this. It's not only that it's a better solution to the separation of powers. It's not only that it's a better solution to the tr peaceful transition of power. It's not only that everyone is united in its state across the whole world. It's unstoppable. And we don't know what it's like to have an empire that lasts for more than 500 years of sound with sound money and no decadence, right? Like even the empires that lasted the longest had their dark periods where the money was debased. Even the American Empire, right? We went through the devaluation of the dollar. Like we've been through a lot of things. We went through the Great Depression and now the Great Financial Crisis, all of these things that all had something to do with the debasing of the dollar and the printing of it and doing something. You cannot debase Bitcoin. So that I think is where this thing becomes an empire for us all. It's to last for a really long time. And we're in the earliest days of this, so early that it's kind of hard to recognize that it's about to become an empire. But that's how all these new empire startups get started. Nobody says, oh, there's going to be an American empire. It's like, well, America gets founded, they fight a revolution, okay, they're the colonies. History happens, and at the end of World War II, they're the world's leading superpower, but they weren't before, and now they're the global empire for 70 years or so. But the leadership gets decadent, the currency gets debased. It's time for another empire, and everyone's looking around. Who's the next empire? Is it going to be China? It sure feels like it's going to be China. They seem to have a lot of power, but maybe it's China allied with the BRICS nations and this and that. And the other. I'm telling you, it's Bitcoin. And that power of creating a empire in which every citizen is free and every citizen has joined the empire voluntarily, and any citizen in the world can join that empire at any point in time voluntarily, is going to be really powerful. We're still in the very earliest days of people recognizing that they want to be a part of this. For obviously for your listeners and for you and me, I mean, we've made that our choice already. Because we've been interested in this thing. But you get these moments like when Michael Saylor first picks up on Bitcoin. It's like, well, here I'm going to join this, right? This thing. And I'm going to be an advocate for it. I'm going to protect it and I'm going to preserve it. I'm going to advocate for it. And he's undoubtedly had a big impact on persuading a lot of people to become Bitcoiners. And then you start to see something like El Salvador, where a whole nation says, okay, we accept that this is usable as money. We're not going to fight it. We're going to accept it. Maybe we'll see something in Argentina. Maybe we're seeing something already starting to happen in the United States, not uniformly. America is very decentralized and very divided. So parts of America are going and parts of China are going, right? Well, let's not forget that there's still a lot of mining taking place in China, and most of the mining equipment is manufactured there. So it's happening all over the world. This empire grows not by conquering nations and killing the population that doesn't agree to accept its rules. It grows voluntarily and peacefully, one person at a time. So it's no surprise it's not going to grow as fast as the Mongol Empire that went and murdered everybody who they could. It's going to grow voluntarily, one person at a time. But so it's going to grow with these much more sustainable principles than the Mongol Empire grew at. It's going to grow with a sustainable principle of everyone gets to choose to be a citizen here. And you don't have to apply for citizenship. Everyone is permitted to be a citizen of Bitcoin. You just run a node, run the software, work for it, trade for it, ask for it. It's so similar to the structures that we've set up in nations that have been flawed without the flaws. And I think that's the overall theme of these four pieces that I've written, is this thing is much more like politics and nations than it is like Facebook, right? Than it is like MySpace. If you're comparing it to a website, you're vastly underestimating what this thing is. Even if you're just comparing it to money, you're somewhat vastly understanding it because money and nationhood is so in government are so interlinked together. And this does what governments do, at least within a narrow context, but a pretty broad one, right? Money is, it's half of everything, right? It's half of every transaction. It makes the world go round. It's a really, really big thing. And if you solve for the money and make it incorruptible, undebasable, decentralized, peer-to-peer, all these things that Bitcoin does that we couldn't do with traditional governments, whether it was democracy or monarchy or any other system of government, we weren't able to have perfect union. We weren't able to have peaceful transition of power. We weren't able to maintain separation of powers to prevent corruption. And here we have this incorruptible system of inviolable rules that recognize and respect people's rights, and we have it forever. And then, so I think this is the historic moment where humanity just takes a giant leap forward by being able to use technology for something that it was just using human relationships for in the past, that's able to use math for something it was just using trust for in the past. This is the breakthrough that Bitcoin represents.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up historic. I want to read a little piece from the United States of Bitcoin. Bitcoin represents a leap forward in civilization itself. Where the US Constitution declared that we are all equal, Bitcoin, within its context of money, ensures we are all treated equally under completely transparent rules. Where the US Constitution sought justice, tranquility, and liberty, Bitcoin delivers these within its context of money with inviolable rules that nobody can break. The release of Bitcoin was a singular event, but like all historic events, it will take time to make its full impact. Bitcoin was itself designed to advance only over a long time frame, as it is forced on nobody and will take over 100 years to issue the fixed supply of coins. We must therefore be patient to watch history unfold, but we must also do our part to first develop our own conviction that we want to be a part of this historic leap and to help others understand why they too would benefit from a world with greater freedom, equality, justice, tranquility, and abundance. And it makes me think a lot about, like, and I don't know if these are answerable questions, but like, are empires good or bad? Are they inevitable? You know,
Well, empires often start very good and turn very bad, right? Like the reason that they rise, I mean, some of them are just bloody takeovers of territory, but many of them are those whose ruins still stand, like the Roman Empire. Well, there was a lot of good that the Roman there's a great Monty Python skits. What have the Romans ever done for us? Oh, they gave us the aqueduct and education and peace and this. But there is. They built great things, and you, by modern standards, we may judge how they built some of these things as somewhat negatively. But the alternative was living in a barbaric civilization, right? So they brought civilization forward, but they all suffered the same fate. They became corrupted, they became decadent. The rules got broken, and when the rules got broken, especially by the elites and the rulers, there was nobody to punish the elites. There was nobody to reinforce, reestablish the rules, and the thing eventually became weaker to the point of collapsing, for one reason or another. But the ruins still stand, and it's interesting that we call them ruins, right? The empire is ruined. What it built at the time still stands, and those Roman aqueducts still stand and still work. You know, you talk about building something to last. Bitcoin started an empire by building its money soundly first. It didn't build a temple. It didn't build a palace. It didn't build a Senate building. It didn't build a government building. It built a money that is indestructible. And I think this is going to be the game changer for empires. This will become the most powerful empire in the world, not through military conquest, but through being indestructible and being appealing for people to volunteer. To voluntarily participate in, right? And so what that was really America's great strength, right? Everybody wanted to come to America because America protected and preserved your rights and gave you the opportunity of the American dream. Bitcoin is something like that. I'm actually working on a piece right now. I'm calling the Bitcoinian dream that asks what happened to the American dream and is a bigger version of it starting to manifest itself in what we might call the Bitcoinian dream. So
I love that.
I'm very, very bullish on Bitcoin. And I'm not talking about its price. It's measured in US dollars. I'm talking about the value it's going to bring to human civilization for generations, thousands of years to come.
Wow. And thinking along those lines and what's to come, like, was America or the United States an accidental empire?
Yeah, it never set, I don't think empires ever set out to be empires, right? Like there was some group that grew bigger and bigger and more powerful and had some effect, whether it was effective technology or effective military strategy or something. They grew, you know, they grew their geography, and they eventually realized they were an empire, and they declared somebody as an emperor. Someone started. Okay, I've recently watched Napoleon, the Apple TV version of it, on an airplane, and you know, Napoleon became emperor. He started as a cannon gunner, and he became president, and then they became king, and then he became emperor. They went through everything from republic to democracy to monarchy to empire. But you know, that wasn't the vision initially. It was just military conquest eventually led them there. Empire is not necessarily an evil term, even though we all think it is because of Star Wars. But empires can turn evil, right? And presumably, even in Star Wars, the Empire was originally a force for good. That's how it got so big, and so many countries joined it. But then darkness crept in, and the Sith Lord took over, and what have you. So that's a fictional empire as opposed to the real empires. But they all follow a similar story arc, right? They start off ambitious, powerful, and this is where Ray Dalio's book is actually quite excellent. He speaks to the virtues of empires in their youth. And then they hit this turning point with generational handover to bad leaders, and then the whole thing goes to hell in a handbasket. I think, well, why isn't this going to happen to Bitcoin? And it's as long as we don't have any leaders, it won't get in the hands of bad leaders. And so that's really important to protect and preserve in Bitcoin. And I think it's what happened. You know, we can see what happened when forks of it got launched. The leadership very quickly turned bad. Like Bitcoin Cash very quickly had leadership that was highly dubious in their intentions and conduct, especially since Craig Wright was one of the initial, you know, supporters. But then he had a falling out, and you know, he forked off into Bitcoin SV. And you just see these systems with leaders have this problem of corruption. If you name the leaders of Ethereum, the leaders of Cardano, the leaders of any of these things, they're dubious characters already. Like, it's not even a generation in. It's like the founders were dubious to begin with in every one of these instances. But we would be setting ourselves up for the same problem if we said, oh, you know, here's a really benevolent leader of Bitcoin. Let's make him the leader. Satoshi's greatest gift to Bitcoin, apart from birthing it, was leaving it. And ending the notion that there was going to be any leadership in this thing. And when that was done, the die was cast for the next, you know, 10,000 years that there will be no leader of Bitcoin. At least we have, you know, if we can fight to preserve that, then we'll continue to have this empire of peace and, you know, non-debasement and non-collapse that's for us all.
Wow. I have one final question on these four pieces before we maybe schmooze for a second and roll out. Is Bitcoin an invulnerable empire? I mean, you mentioned, you know, forever, you mentioned how
Yes.
powerful it is. And I wonder, you know, is there a Satoshi's heel?
Yeah, it doesn't have an Achilles heel. I think I mentioned that in the beginning of my piece. I think the Achilles heel to Bitcoin is if Bitcoiners become complacent. And really, essentially, all of them, right? Like, even if all over the world a whole bunch of Bitcoiners become complacent and they fork off and do something, but there's some remnant who hold on to Bitcoin's principles and preserve it, then Bitcoin survives until everybody else comes back to it, realizing that having corrupted it led to its collapse, but that somewhere it was preserved. So I do think that there's every reason to believe that Bitcoin will continue to thrive and survive for a really long time. And I realize I'm making an unprecedented prediction, right? Like, nothing before Bitcoin survived forever. Every other institution has fallen. New religions have risen, and new empires have risen, and new systems of politics have risen and fallen. All of these things have gone. So why should this one last? And I may turn out to be wrong, but I think the mechanisms that I discussed in these two articles, like the separation of powers and the transition of power, it is a system that is incorruptible, and indestructible. And I think that's what many people have recognized. That's why so many engineers have come to it before politicians have come to it, because they see, oh, this is an engineered, indestructible, perpetual system of operation, and it gets stronger and stronger the more people are connected to it. So I think that's what makes it unique, right? I think empires tend to achieve an economy of scale and then a diseconomy of scale. Like, the longer they are, the bigger they are, the harder they get to manage, right? It's really hard to manage the American Empire now. Whoever's president, whoever's the chief of staff, whoever's, the joint chiefs of, like, there is just, it's really, really hard to manage the whole fucking world. And Bitcoin makes it simple again for people to manage in a totally decentralized manner the ledger of all the money in the world. It's really unprecedented. And again, to manage it in a way where you don't have dispute about it, to manage it in a way where you have unity all over the world around it. We've never had agreement all over the world on anything. We have agreement all over the world about the exact state of Bitcoin and every change to its state. That's unprecedented.
Yeah, I mean, it's the greatest mechanism of social consensus in the world. I think Nick Szabo kind of outlined that, where he's like, you 150 people is kind of like the biggest a community can get or your circle can get without really using a third party, a centralized third party, to manage it. And Bitcoin has got millions of participants in social consensus, which is amazing. And there's no leakage, which is where I think the forever part of where the forever comes. And it's indestructible. You speak of no leakage, and you've now been on six of 197 Bitcoin Matrix podcast episodes. That's 3% of all my shows. So I'm a lucky guy. And those are there forever. So to kind of roll out here, fresh news, Julian Assange appears to be a free man. We'll see how that plays out. He still has to go through U.S. territories, and
I think it's done. I
well,
think
he's I guess he left Australia. I don't know where he's going from there.
yeah, but he's
But
a U.S. judge has accepted his plea, agreed that time
tough
has.
plea.
Oh, he had to plead
Well,
guilty.
yeah, he had to plead guilty, which is a precedent for journalism, I think.
Well, we'll see how it all plays out. The whole thing is kind of messy, but at least
Sure.
hearts can be warmed that Julian Assange is out of prison and a free man, and he had his preposterous airplane bill paid off by some anonymous Bitcoiner,
Right. Imagine the AP, the AR clerk who had to send off that invoice.
Well, so, it's a step forward, and the Julian Assange story is very closely tied to the politics of Bitcoin, right? Like, he was one of the first to get definancialized, to get financially locked out by the state.
But there was some drama there. I mean, Satoshi was like not now at first and disappeared shortly after. And
There's a, I mean, that we could do.
man.
I'd encourage you to get someone who's more expert on the history of this than myself, but there's a whole show to be done on the connections between Julian Assange and Satoshi and Bitcoin
Right.
from the dawn of Bitcoin to now, and maybe even more forward. Like, there's a really interesting story to be told there. Satoshi did leave, almost certainly in part because he was worried that Julian Assange had kicked the hornet's nest, WikiLeaks had kicked the hornet's nest, and in accepting Bitcoin was now going to direct the attention of the hornets towards Bitcoin, which Satoshi felt was fragile and vulnerable at the time. Even Satoshi didn't appreciate how important it was that Bitcoin get attacked by hornets to strengthen itself. But Bitcoin survived, right? And Bitcoin didn't end up in prison for 14 years. Bitcoin flourished during that time. Could have flourished more potentially without this, or maybe it would have withered without this. Like, it's hard to, we don't have a parallel universe to run a simulation, and Bitcoin's done fine. And Julian Assange had to suffer a great deal for what he tried to do. So I'd say leave that man alone right now. He's already a hero on everybody's books, and let him live in peace however he wants to live right now.
Yeah, for sure. I just did two shows with some of the guys from Ocean, Luke Dasher and Bitcoin Mechanic. And so I can't help but think, there are amendments to the United States Constitution. Some have been great, like the first two. I think the second one kind of enforces and holds up the first one, but you know, I don't know if they get better after that or how much better, and some might not be so great, who knows. But I can't help but think, you know, Bitcoin is software, it's a protocol, there's going to be maintenance, there's going to be repairs needed and things of this nature. But my final two questions. So are you going to be in Nashville? I almost said Miami. It just feels like Miami is like the name of it. But
I don't currently have plans to go to Nashville. They may change last minute, but my next conference that I know that I'm going to is Pacific Bitcoin. So if you want to find me at a conference, I'll for sure be there.
Well, cool. I hope to see you both. So that'd be great. And then, you know, I'll leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find you and your work and Swan. Before, I'd love for you, you know, kind of go over that before, you know, reading out maybe the end of Bitcoin and Empire for us all.
Okay. Yeah, no, there's not much more to say. If in your show notes, you put a link to those four articles we discussed on the Swan blog, I think that's more than good enough. And if you also put links to some of my other stuff, that's great. There has been a movie version of the legendary Treasure of Satoshi Nakamoto released since I last appeared on your podcast to read it. And I really encourage people to watch it. That is on the Swan Bitcoin YouTube channel. So if you Google legendary Treasure of Satoshi Nakamoto, Swan YouTube, something like that, you'll find it. It's a 38-minute film. So sit, you know, set aside some time to watch it, but it's a very powerful piece. And we've gotten lots of amazing reviews for it. And it really speaks to how Bitcoin, a different topic than what we've been discussing today, about how Bitcoin is really a spiritual awakening for the self and how it allows people to discover their true self and become their true self. So really encourage people to do that. And that's it. Let me then take us to the readout of the rise of the empire of the coin from Bitcoin is an empire for us all, which you can find on the Swan blog. So it begins with, let us recall that throughout history, you could always tell which empire you were in based on the coin used. In disputed territory, more than one coin might be used. But whatever empire you are in, you utilize the coin of the realm. And wherever a coin is utilized, you are in the realm of that coin. So where is Bitcoin used? It has no homeland, yet it exists at once everywhere on Earth. Its operators, accountants, or scribes who track its ledger operate in almost every country. Perhaps it even already operates in every single country on Earth. Anyone who runs a Bitcoin node anywhere in the world is maintaining Bitcoin's currency, Bitcoin, in that country. There are tens of thousands of such people spread out across the globe. Even more are trading their empire's money for this new coin because they see something special in it. They see that it is invulnerable to debasement, which is also known as money printing. Bitcoin is not printed onto paper on a press. It is not forged or stamped out of metal at a mint. It is made from mathematical formulae expressed as computer code requiring energy. This creation process, for which there was no word at the time of Bitcoin's creation, is often called mining. But it is not like mining for coal, nickel, or gold. The mathematical formulae ensure that only 21 million Bitcoin will ever be created. They ensure that the time frame over which these coins will be issued is the same. They provide anyone in the world with the easy ability to verify the authenticity and genuineness of any coin offered to them in exchange for their services. And nobody, not now, and not in many generations, can debase the coin by making more of it or making it less pure. Bitcoin is the unprintable coin. It is the undilutable coin. It is undebasable. We must, after all, either create new words for this new phenomenon or attempt to apply old words imperfectly. As Bitcoin spreads to more people worldwide, it establishes a new type of empire. I wish I had a word for it, but it is the first of its kind, and possibly, since it could last forever, the last as well. Like other empires before it, Bitcoin establishes a coin for an economy covering a vast geography. But Bitcoin does not spread as other empires before it have. Bitcoin does not take over nations by military conquest. It does not force any individual to accept it. It does not seize and destroy or make illegal the use of any other coin. Bitcoin spreads peacefully through earning the choice of those who choose it. And those who choose it for themselves also, for the value it gives to them. Unlike all empires before it, Bitcoin does not have leaders. All people are equals in the empire of Bitcoin. The same rules apply to all, and they are simple rules. First, you may only spend coins that are unspent. That is, you may only spend them if you can prove ownership of them by providing a digital signature corresponding to encrypted spending instructions. Second, you may only add a block of transactions to the ledger if it meets the conditions of doing so. These are the only rules. There are no other rules. But unlike the laws of previous empires, these rules are not open to human interpretation or violation. They are designed to be scrutinized only by the operations of mathematics. And each transaction and block either passes or fails, objectively, mathematically, according to all participants in the empire. No emperor will someday become decadent and decide to print more Bitcoin to finance a war or build himself a monument. There is no emperor in this empire. It is an empire whose citizens choose to be in it because they do not want to be ruled by the whims of some ruler. Bitcoin's unique construction protects this empire from ever being able to commit the deadly sin or become victim to the act that destroyed every empire that has come before, the inflation and debasement of its coin. This empire is neither naive about nor vulnerable to those who seek power over others. It has no Achilles heel. There is nowhere that you can strike it and kill it. If you take out nodes anywhere on Earth, you have done nothing to harm the operation of Bitcoin. If you withdraw energy from its process of adding blocks, it will adjust itself in short order to ensure its ongoing process of adding valid blocks of valid transactions returns to its targeted rate of one block every 10 minutes. If you try the opposite, to flood it with energy, it will adapt to this as well. Make any attempt to inflate the supply, and your attempt will be mathematically rejected by every node in the world. Try to pass off anything that is not 100% pure Bitcoin as a transaction, and your attempt will also be mathematically rejected by every node in the world. Nobody can stop the operation of this empire of the coin. So the choice then is simply to accept it or reject it. And that is a free choice for every person on the planet. The empire of the coin invites all to choose to join. It rejects nobody who obeys its simple rules, and it forces nobody to join. It is the first empire in history to expand entirely through the voluntary participation of its citizens. The price also rises. Today, many people focus on the investment opportunity that Bitcoin represents over a relatively short time when measured against the lifespan of empires. But what they implicitly are acknowledging in doing so is that what drives this opportunity is this. Bitcoin is not some flash in the pan or Johnny come lately that will soon be replaced by the new thing. Bitcoin may be the new kid on the block as far as empires go, but it defines what the block is better than any empire before it. The more people recognize this, the more this empire rises in both users and economic value. Nothing in history has grown more quickly than Bitcoin to a value of $1 trillion. And Bitcoin did this without hiring a single employee and without spending a dime or a Satoshi on marketing. It did so by offering itself to the world and letting those who saw its value in it join it, work on it, and tell others about it. A forever empire. At this moment in history, Bitcoin is truly the dawn of a new empire. It is an empire of peaceful expansion, voluntary participation, reliable promises, freedom, and an undebasable coin. It offers a provable solution to the problem that led to the collapse of all empires before it. It is a tremendous gift to all humanity, and all we have to do to preserve our civilization and thrive for many generations is accept this gift.
Today's episode with Tomer Strohleit was brought to you by River, the preferred choice for buying Bitcoin. Get up to $100 when you sign up and buy Bitcoin at river.com/matrix. Whether you want all your keys offline, shared custody with trusted contacts, or robust mobile vaults across multiple iPhones, it's your keys, your Bitcoin. Experience the best-in-class Bitcoin multi-sig vaults. Download Theia now at theia.us/Cedric. That's theia.us/CEDRIC. And thank you for tuning in. Keep building, keep stacking, and always be laser focused out there. This is Cedric. Peace.